Hi, Dave Emery here, side two, for the record, program number 784. First, Tame the Intellectuals. This is being recorded on March 30th of the year 2014. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off on side one. For those who may be just tuning in, the quote is from Adolf Hitler, who counseled in order to maintain, to solidify and control state power. He said, quote, "First, tame the intellectuals, then take them to the fields and hitch them to your racehorses." And what we are witnessing is how the intellectuals in the Ukraine, and also in particular, as we are going to see in this side of the program, the intellectuals in Germany and the United States, in particular the media and our political scientific institutions in academia, are being tamed and then taken to the fields and hitched to the racehorses of political and economic power in order to produce the desired propaganda results that our power structure desires in the Ukraine. Again, as you listen to this, never lose sight of the fact that 25% of all of the proven natural gas reserves on Earth are in the Ukraine. That's really what it is about. It certainly is not about democracy. On the contrary, the elements that are in power in the Ukraine are not only overtly fascist, they are Nazi, and they are directly, explicitly, and gladly evolved from the Third Reich collaborationist forces of the OUNB, the UPA, and various SS and Einsatzgruppen formations. We'll go into excerpt another post by GermanForeignPolicy.com, which feeds along the lower right-hand side of the SpitfireList.com website. That is my website featuring all of my life's work, plus vast amounts of information from a library of old anti-fascist books, contributions by a contributing editor. It is an invaluable information. So SpitfireList.com, and again, GermanForeignPolicy.com, is one of the blogs that feeds along the lower right-hand side. This is from GermanForeignPolicy.com from March 17th of 2014, titled "The Free World," unquote. It is a sarcastic reference to the West and the way in which a free flow of information and an accurate analysis of what is taking place in the Ukraine is simply forbidden. We're going to take a look at collaboration between the German publication Die Zeit and its editorial policy and official German think tanks and organizations that are helping to formulate a more assertive German foreign policy and German national security policy. As we looked at in the earlier programs about the Ukraine, this is the eighth program about the Ukrainian crisis, for the record, 777 to 783. Basically, the U.S. really has no dog in this fight. Some of the U.S. fossil fuel companies are involved with the natural gas situation in the Ukraine. But what this is about is folding the Ukraine into the EU, and the U.S. is not part of the EU. In addition to the collaboration between Die Zeit and its editorial policy and German national security policy, note as we make the transition to the other side of the Atlantic, this side of the Atlantic, that there is a growing pattern of editorial collaboration between Die Zeit and the Gray Lady, the New York Times. And also note that there was a motion filed in the European Parliament to limit the free speech of former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, who was critical of German and Western policy toward the Ukraine. Can you imagine filing a motion in the U.S. House of Representatives to prevent a former president of the U.S. from speaking freely on foreign policy? Anyway, this comes from the, quote, left, unquote, in the European Parliament, actually members of the Green Party, as we looked at in For the Record 628 and 629. The Green Party, although ostensibly left, does actually represent the tamed intellectuals that Hitler advocated its roots, although most people in the Green Parties are distinctly left of center. Do note that the origins of the Green Party in Germany, not only the Green Party, I guess you could say, has its roots, pun intended, not only in the Third Reich, but in the SS. Again, For the Record, 628 and 629, both of them linked to the description. Again, from GermanForeignPolicy.com, The Free World for March 17th, 2014. Skipping down and excerpting. It should also be noted that there is obviously no contradiction with Die Zeit Online's basic principles, unquote, to closely cooperate with both Berlin's and Washington's foreign policy networks. For example, Die Zeit editor Jochen Bittner, B-I-T-T-N-E-R, had participated in a cooperation project sponsored by the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or SWP, and the German Marshall Fund, which, promoted by the policy planning staff of Germany's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, wrote the study, quote, Elements of a Foreign Policy Strategy for Germany. Critics draw parallels between the contents of the projected paper, New Power, New Responsibility, and standpoints or editorial points expressed in Bittner's articles. Die Zeit has published no disclaimer, unquote, under his articles. The same applies to the articles written by Die Zeit's co-producer, Josef Jaffe. His text became one of the subjects of a media science dissertation published last year. The author arrives at the conclusion that Jaffe not only mingles in elite transatlantic ideological circles supplemented with an EU component, unquote, a reference to his membership in diverse organizations for German and transatlantic foreign policy, but he even promotes key objectives of the German or transatlantic establishment in part as propaganda within his published texts. By the way, pausing briefly, do note that the German foreign minister met with Oleg Tjahnibuk, the leader of the Svoboda Party, the day after Svoboda had a celebration honoring the founding of the 14th Waffen-SS Division. Note the collaboration between the policy planning staff of the German Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Die Zeit. And note the following. The level reached by the intensification of Russophobe agitation can be seen in an attempt by a green European parliamentarian to partially strip former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder of his right to freedom of speech. Schröder recently spoke quite critically on the EU's Ukraine policy and during a public event declared, quote, I wonder if it was the right thing to do to place a culturally divided country such as the Ukraine before the alternative, association agreement with the EU or customs agreement with Russia, unquote. Rebecca Harms, H-A-R-M-S, the leading Green Party candidate in the upcoming European parliamentary elections, issued a statement saying that she considers Schröder's statement, quote, part of a campaign, unquote, to, quote, win more sympathy for Putin, unquote. Last Thursday, together with another Green Party politician, Daniel Cohn-Bendit, she therefore tabled a motion in the European Parliament that the Parliament finds Schröder's statement regrettable, unquote, and reiterates, unquote, that the former German Chancellor, again quoting, should refrain from making public statements on Russia, unquote. Again, that is a stunning thing. By the way, Daniel Cohn-Bendit was one of the stars of the New Left in Europe in the 1968 social upheavals. Well, I guess his actions speak for themselves. Again, note that they are trying to limit the free speech of a former German chancellor, saying he should refrain from making public statements on Russia. The European Parliament, by the way, rejected that. Continuing with GermanForeignPolicy.com's text. With amazement, the European Parliament has rejected an attempt by the German Greens to restrict the right to freedom of expression in a precedent case. Nevertheless, this incident is but an indication that still standing democratic taboos could be broken in the current frenzy of Russophobe agitation without consequences for the perpetrators. The power struggle over the Ukraine as the backdrop is perceived in Berlin as a, quote, test run, unquote, for the new German foreign policy. To be successful, this new policy must win broad popular support at home by any means necessary. Or as Hitler put it, first tame the intellectuals, then take them to the fields and hitch them to your racehorses. By the way, this is being done in the U.S. We're going to turn now to the New York Times, although it remains by far and away America's best newspaper. It also is the CIA's number one propaganda asset, and one should never lose sight of that. The Gray Lady, as the New York Times is known, has been showing her CIA petticoats quite a bit lately. I wonder, as we look at the above-mentioned Jochen Bittner, one of the top people, top editors at Die Zeit, he is now a regular contributor to the op-ed pages of the New York Times. I wonder to what extent that is the result of efforts by Serge Schmemann, whom we looked at in For the Record 782. He was the Bonn correspondent for the New York Times when Bonn was the capital of what was then West Germany and later to the unified Germany. He wrote a very slanted editorial for a book review, I should say, of Christopher Simpson's book Blowback. His grandfather was a member of the Imperial Life Guards, a white Russian guard for the Tsar. He then moved to France. We have asked the question about whether his grandfather may have collaborated with the Promethean League as sort of a pre-wackle-wackle. I also wonder about his father's presence in France. He was a university student at the University of Paris from 1940 through 1945. The vast bulk of that time was during the German occupation of France. I wonder to what extent any member of the Schmemann family, grandfather, father, or Serge himself, may have networked with intelligence elements, whether the pre-World War II Promethean League. I wonder about his father and who he might have networked when he was a university student in Vichy, France, Nazi-occupied France. I also wonder about Serge Schmemann's possible intelligence connections as well. Schmemann, I had not seen his name in quite some time. Lately, he has been featured in the op-ed pages of the New York Sunday New York Times, sort of managing and interpreting things for the lowly masses, unquote, who read the newspaper. Jochen Bittner, again, discussed above as one of the top editors of Die Zeit and a man who overtly is collaborating with German state ministries and national security interests, and whose editorials have coincided quite closely with the stated policies of those interests. The New York Times has a compilation of Jochen Bittner's op-ed pieces for the New York Times. Another thing that I found striking about the way the Gray Lady has operated, P-Ride, I can't say the name, it's a Russian female punk group. Their full name, I'm going to have to say P-Riot because their name uses a slang term for the female genitalia beginning with P that I can't say on the air. They have run afoul of the Russian authorities, and in particular they staged a protest at the Sochi Olympics in which they wore ski masks, in some ways representative or reminiscent, I should say, of the 1972 terrorists who massacred Israeli athletes at the Olympics. They were then beaten and arrested. Within 2 days, they had an op-ed piece in the New York Times. you're just not going to see punk rockers getting guest editorials in the New York Times, and you won't see anything that uses the P word getting guest editorials in the New York Times, but P Riot sure as hell did, and they weren't alone. During the Ukrainian crisis, the New York Times of March 19th of 2014 featured a guest editorial and op-ed piece by Alexei Navalny, last name, N as in Nancy, A, V as in Victor, A-L-N-Y. It's called How to Punish Putin. As we attempt to ascertain what the real truth is and read between the lines of what our Ministry of Truth is letting us know, handicapping our media is not easy. Frankly, we are being told that Vladimir Putin is the devil incarnate. I certainly do not believe what Putin's PR flacks say about him or what the Russian media do, but I simply do not believe what we are being told by the Ministry of Truth. The objective truth lies somewhere between Russian liars and our liars, and exactly what it is remains to be determined. On the Ukraine, at least, the Russians are telling the truth, and our Ministry of Truth is lying away. One of the features of our media has been, and our propaganda, has been to portray the Russian political opposition of Alexei Navalny. He is the number one figure as democratic and as opposed to the repressive autocrat Vladimir Putin, blah, 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 blah. We're going to take a look at Alexei Navalny and what he really is as a political animal. Again, the New York Times of March 19th of 2014 featured an op-ed piece by Alexei Navalny, How to Punish Putin, unquote. It reads in part, as I write this, I am under house arrest. I was detained at a rally in support of anti-Putin protesters who were jailed last month. In September, I ran for mayor of Moscow as a pro-reform, pro-democracy opposition candidate and received almost a third of the vote despite having no access to state media. Today, my blog, which was until recently visited by over 2 million readers per month, has been blocked as extremist, unquote, after I called for friendly ties with the Ukraine and compliance with international law. Well, again, Alexei Navalny is being portrayed as a saint of sorts. We are going to take a look at what Alexei Navalny really is. The political opposition in Russia is sort of divided between an urban upper middle class who, as far as I can tell, are relatively successful and materialistic, and a nationalist movement. Again, the word nationalist is the new speak term for fascist, a working class nationalist movement that is explicitly racist and, like many of the new Euro-fascist movements, targets people of Muslim extraction and people whose skins are somewhat darker as the focal point of their racist agitation and scapegoating. What Alexei Navalny has been doing is mounting an opposition coalition in which he is uniting the urban upper middle class, the professional class, and their materialist interests with the street racist, Euro-fascist, so to speak, of the quote-unquote nationalist movement. And as we're going to see, Alexei Navalny is very comfortable with the fascist element in the Russian opposition. He has no problem with their doctrinaire racism. An article from Aid, Netherlands, of December 31st, 2011, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, uniting nationalists and the urban, educated middle class. Skipping down. The 35-year-old Muscovite lawyer is also emblematic of two forces that were once supporters of Putin but are now increasingly turning against him. The urban, educated middle class, or ROG, as pundit Stanislav Belkovsky has dubbed them, and Russians with nationalist sympathies. On the surface, these two groups appear antithetical to one another. Skipping down. The nationalists are portrayed as racist, working class, street thugs whose sense of Russian victimhood speaks to fists and boots to the migrants from Central Asia and the North Caucasus. Nevertheless, both groups share common ground. They are, by and large, suspicious of the West and the Russian liberals who extol its values. Patriotic, they despise corruption, view immigrants as destroying the integrity of the Russian nation, and increasingly loathe Putin and his cronies. With a foot in each world, Navalny is emerging as the logical person who could unite them around a new mass political movement based on what Alexei Pimenov recently called an anti-corruption pathos plus the national idea. That national idea, basically, is, again, it's fascism. And one should never lose sight of what the newspeak means by that. An article from the New York Times of January 29th of 2012. For more than two decades, Russian liberals have been warning of the dangers posed by nationalism, often portraying it as a greater threat to freedom and stability in this multi-ethnic country than the soft authoritarianism of Mr. Putin, Russia's once and probably future president. In recent years, the nationalist movement has become large and increasingly malignant, responsible for a pattern of racist violence against non-Slavs that includes kidnapping, torture, and murder. Nationalists have been responsible for several beheadings. But in an effort to drive out Mr. Putin, the opposition, driven by liberal and middle-class Russians, has nonetheless reached out to nationalists, seeing them as a vital bulwark at a critical moment. And skipping down again, Mr. Ponomaryov has said he initially resisted the inclusion of nationalist leaders but relented when members agreed to sign a pact denouncing xenophobia and racism. That sounds like Svoboda. Skipping down again. There are limits to the liberals' tolerance, however, when the avowed white supremacist Maxim Marcinkevich, nicknamed the Hatchet, made the top three in an online vote for speakers at the second protest, organizers stepped in and denied him the microphone. More about Alexei Navalny. This from Salon.com, an AP story of December 27th of 2011. Alexei Navalny, key engine behind Russian protests, by Lynn Berry and Vladimir Sashenkov. Sashenkov, S-A-C-H-E-N-K-O-V. Skipping down, it reads in part, Navalny took part in last month's Russian march in which thousands of nationalists marched through Moscow to call on ethnic Russians to take back their country, some raising their hands in a Nazi salute. And again, Navalny participated in that particular march. Still more about Alexei Navalny. This from the Exiled Online blog of December 26th of 2011, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, uniting nationalists and the urban educated middle classes, by Sean Guillory, and it reads in part. Among his other nationalist fits, he wrote off the neo-fascist movement against illegal immigration as harmless as Girl Scouts, unquote, declared that immigrants, quote, will never assimilate, unquote, and are a bomb under our future, unquote, called on Russians to arm themselves against Muslim-looking criminals, unquote, supported the nationalist-inspired Stop Feeding the Caucasus campaign, and most recently joined the organizing committee of the yearly nationalist powwow, the Russian March. Again, we have heard this before, and Alexei Navalny, although more sophisticated than some, appears to fall quite comfortably within the new parameters of Eurofascism, in which nationalism and anti-immigrant, racist, and xenophobic sentiments are the driving forces, in turn propelled by the social dislocation produced by economic hardship. One of the things that I wonder about is the extent to which the urban middle class that is discussed in as part of the coalition that Alexei Navalny could put together has evolved from the contacts that were made by the Free Congress Foundation, which networked with the IRG group that was put together by Boris Yeltsin during the closing phase of the during the decline of the former Soviet Union. And for the record, 778, we excerpted some information from AFA program number 36, and that in turn was from an article called The Free Congress Foundation Goes East, co-authored by Russ Ballant and Lewis Wolf, that from covert action of number 35 from the fall of 1990. And in that article, it talks about the Free Congress Foundation's networking with the IRG, and in turn how organizations like the OUNB, forebearers and role models for Svoboda and Pravi Sektor, many European fascist organizations that had collaborated with the Third Reich, were represented in the elements that were networking with the IRG. And skipping down in that very same article, we read, finally, FCF's insinuation into the politics of the East must be judged by their selection of Laszlo Pastor to head their Liberation Support Alliance, quote, which seeks to liberate peoples in Central and Eastern European nations, unquote. Pastor's involvement in East European politics began in World War II when he joined the youth organization of the Arrow Cross, the Nazi Party of Hungary. When the Arrow Cross was installed in power by a German commando operation, Pastor was sent to Berlin to help facilitate the liaison between the Arrow Cross and Adolf Hitler. Pastor was tried and served 2 years in jail for his Arrow Cross activities after an anti-communist government was elected in 1945. He eventually came to the U.S. and established the ethnic arm of the Republican National Committee for Richard Nixon. He brought other Nazi collaborators from the Eastern Front into the GOP, some of whom were later found to have participated in mass murder during the war. The dormant Arrow Cross has surfaced again in Hungary where there have been attempts to lift the ban on the organization, this being written in 1990, by the way. Pastor spent several months in Hungary when Free Congress Foundation head Paul Weyrich later conducted training there. He was provided a list of Pastor's contacts inside the country. Weyrich reports that he conducted training for the recently formed and now governing New Democratic Forum. Pastor claims to have assisted some of his friends in Hungary in getting National Endowment for Democracy funds through his advisory position with NED. In 1989, he spoke at the Heritage Foundation under the sponsorship of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN, a multinational umbrella organization of emigre fascists and Nazis founded in alliance with Hitler in 1943. It is led by the OUN. Pastor spoke for the Hungarian organization of ABN, which is the Arrow Cross. And I would note that the Arrow Cross has led directly to the Jobbik Party in the creation of and ascension of the Jobbik Party in Hungary, which networks with Svoboda. Note also that as we look at in For the Record 710, and as will be included in the description for the Record 784, elements of Western and Saudi intelligence have been backing the jihadists in the Caucasus, something that is certainly affecting Russian policy and something we should not lose sight of. However, we are all out of time in this particular program. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 784. First, Tame the Intellectuals. This has been recorded on March 30th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.